Join. Let it start off here. So it's Monday, the 27th, 2:30, Chem 12A lab. And what I wanted to talk about today was formal reports in writing, because when we spend so much time on techniques, the one thing that we neglect or forget is about the writing. And the writing component is a huge component of being a scientist and being a chemist and of chemistry. So our science in particular, it doesn't matter how good a scientist you are, you can come up with world changing ideas and concepts and technology. And if you can't communicate it, then it doesn't do anybody any good. So communication in general is really 2/3 of being a scientist. So you have 1/3 that is actually working in the lab, coming up with ideas and doing research. You have another 1/3 that is written communication, that are all of the communications that you would send out, the writing up of your data, the peer-reviewed journal articles, communications to the editors, and communicating with your peers in other ways. So written communication is at least another 1/3. And then oral communication is the last 1/3. So the oral communication is verbally communicating with your peers, your superiors, but also going to scientific conferences and communicating out through oral talks. That's at least another 1/3. So you've got 2/3 of the science, which is communication, and only 1/3 that is working in the lab. And we put all this emphasis on working on the lab, which is correct, because that's where we are at this point. It's all of these things are new. And so we spend all this enormous amount of time working and teaching you how to work in the lab. But we also need to spend a good amount of time teaching you how to communicate effectively and be effective communicators. And so that starts with writing and with doing formal reports. And this is the point in the lab where I generally start to do that, is with the acetyl salicylic acid synthesis. That synthesis is the first one where we do a formal report. And we're not going to do a formal report for this, because a formal report requires that you sort of did the work yourself, you had hands-on when the lab was being done, and then from those hands-on experiments and experiences, you go through and do all the analysis, and you're correlating what you saw and what you did throughout the experiment with the characterizations that you're getting back, and making sense out of those. And since we didn't do those two parts, it really makes no sense for me to give you just random data and have you try to write a formal report using random data. I think that is not the best exercise. And so I am going to have you do a writing exercise, but it's really just going to be a subset. I'm going to have you look at the discussion section and the mechanism, and have you write about the mechanism and explain the mechanism back to me in a particular way, in the way that we would have done it in a formal report. So we'll talk about that a little bit later, but that's going to be the only writing exercise. And so much, much smaller in scope than what I would have. But I do want to spend a good amount of time talking about formal reports, talking about the resources that you have online and other resources that I think are really valuable resources, and going through my outlines of what I think is important in terms of formal reports. So that's sort of the outline of where I want to go today. And so let's see what I want to do. I think what I need to do is I need to screen share my computer and start off with this. And we're going to start off from, my homepage here on chemed.study. And what I want to look at is the formal report guidelines that are here. So we're going to spend time looking in two different places. We're going to talk about the formal report guideline, and then I'll spend a little bit of time going over the rubric itself and the formal report rubric. And then we'll break into the iPad again and do a little bit of writing and show you some mechanism stuff and talk about where I want to go with that. So about a smaller lecture today, not as big a lecture today, and mostly on writing and communicating. So whenever you write a journal article, a peer-reviewed article, your first step is always going to the website and going to the page for authors. So if you were writing to the Journal of the American Chemical Society, and I don't know where they have it, but usually on their cover page, they have for authors. And under authors, they usually have all these guidelines, author guidelines. So here they are, important submission requirements, document templates. All of that information is presented here by the publication itself. And their instructions for authors are always the first place when you start to write a journal article. That's the first thing you do, is you go and you read all of their author guidelines. And within these guidelines, they will have all of the different information that you need. What are the margins on the page that they expect? What different fields do they want? Do they want the abstract, the methods and materials, the discussion, the introduction, all of those different sections that they want? What format do they want those sections in? Do they want them in a single paragraph, or do they want them in two columns on a page? What size should the all of the diagrams be? Should they be half page, or should they be smaller or bigger? What point typeface do you use? What typeface actually do you use? All of these different things are listed out in the instructions for authors. And so being that that's the first place that you go, you're writing to the Journal of Organic Chemistry for Jason Camera. And so you need to go to our formal report guidelines and the rubric and see what it is that we need to put together here. So let's start with these formal report guidelines. And I don't have any templates up, and I probably should, but I've been hesitant to do that yet. I don't know why. I think it's because not everybody uses Word. There's Word, there's Pages, there's a lot of different things, and I didn't want to put together a whole bunch of different templates, and so I've just kind of put together document formatting things. And to be clear, in the start of this, that these formal written laboratory report guidelines were written by Christy Vogel and I before Christy retired. And Christy was the Chem 1B teacher before Albie. And Albie and I have not sat down together and done this. That's actually, Albie and I should sit down and do this too. But we put together a set of guidelines that would be consistent between Chem 1B and Chem 12. And there's some small differences because of the content difference in the way that you write about a Chem 12B paper, right? In Chem 12B, it's much more analytical, and you're looking at answers through which there's a lot of math in order to chunk through to get to the actual answer. And so your main topic there is looking at the sample calculations and how did you actually go through and do the calculation, and some of the theory and things. And then your percent error is your main discussion point as to how far off was your answer from the accepted answer. But within an organic chemistry context, there is no sample calculations. There is no long mathematical process that we go through. And in terms of the product that you get, we go through and do a product characterization, but there's no expected answer in that. What is your percent error with the accepted percent yield that you're supposed to get? That's not a good way to compare. What we like to do is we like to compare whether or not you got the expected product and understanding of its characterization. And so that's a part that we put a lot of emphasis on. And your percent yield is just a very simple calculation. So we don't need any example calculations of how you actually go through and do that. So there's some differences between Chem 1B and Chem 12, but the rest of it is all pretty much the same. So this is what we kind of agreed upon. Your document formatting should be on 8.5 by 11 with margins of 1 inch left, 1 inch right, half an inch at the top, and 1 inch at the bottom. There should be a 0.5 inch header and a 0.6 inch footer, and the typeface should be an easily readable font, such as a 12-point Helvetica, Times New Roman, or Palatino. Don't get fancy with the fonts. keep the font nice and simple. You want it readable. So fancy fonts that make it look pretty also make it illegible or harder for us to read, particularly those of us now that are relying on reading glasses in order to get through everything. And 12-point font, don't make the font too small either. I know that we're all trying to save paper, but this is a point where if I am trying to teach writing, then I need to be able to have the ability to be able to edit your paper and to send you back comments. And I can only do that if there's enough room in there for me to comment on things. So double space everything. 12-point font and double space all the text in order to allow for comments. So that's just the setup component. And stop me at any point if you guys have questions. I've got the chat up. I'm watching things again and keeping an eye out for questions. But stop me if anything comes up. The title should be simple. It should not be flowery. It's not a creative writing assignment. So that's something to keep in mind. The title is recommended to be written after the experiment. It should be brief, but grammatically correct and accurate and complete enough to stand alone. The synthesis of acetyl salicylic acid is a perfectly good title. It says exactly what was done. If you wanted to say the synthesis of acetyl salicylic acid from acetic anhydride and phosphoric acid, that also works. It starts getting a little bit longer, but it just should be simple and self-explanatory. The title should include keywords that might engage the reader. For this synthesis, I wouldn't worry about that necessarily, but do avoid phrases such as on the, a study of, report on, use of. These sorts of things are redundant. We're trying to avoid redundancy in our writing. When somebody sits down to read a formal report, it is understood that they are sitting down to read a report on something. So to say a report on the synthesis of acetyl salicylic acid is pretty redundant. It is a report. It's self-explanatory. So just drop the a study of component or report on or use of. Just write exactly what was done. The abstract. The job of the abstract is twofold. The abstract should tell what was done and what was found, and not in great detail. So what was done and what was found, in what was done, you're just summarizing the overall component of what was done. It should be a complete standalone summary. It includes an overview of the general methods and results. It does not include experimental details such as concentrations, temperatures, amounts used, any of those things. We don't tend to use those things. It's past tense and standalone, but should include the results, the major results of whatever was studied. So for instance, if your acetyl salicylic acid had a melting point of 34 to 35 degrees and had a percent yield of, let's say a 91% yield, then your abstract would say something along the lines of, acetyl salicylic acid was synthesized from acetic anhydride and an acid catalyst. The product was isolated as a white powder in a 91% yield with a melting point of 134 to 135 degrees. Characterization by ferric chloride test and FTIR were consistent with literature values for the product. Done. That's all you would need to do for the abstract. And then the rest of it we get to into the instruction. So the major findings were there in the abstract, and what was done was clearly stated. And it shouldn't be a great big long thing. It should be probably maybe 5-6 sentences at most, depending upon how big the study is. So if you're doing a simple synthesis like the acetyl salicylic acid, then you've got maybe 3-4 sentences. If it's a multi-step synthesis where you are going through and doing 4 different products or something like that, well, now all of a sudden your abstract takes on a longer sort of idea. So Finn, yeah, no inflated abstracts. Keep it simple. The introduction. In the introduction, the purpose of the introduction is to stimulate interest and prepare the reader. in the introduction, what we want to do is we want to focus on usually the history of whatever it is that's being studied. And by history, I don't mean the history of everything about acetyl salicylic acid or the history of how it works within the body, although some of those things can be interesting. Usually, in the context of a peer-reviewed journal article, you're working on the shoulders of other people who have done other studies. You are seeing something that has stimulated your interest. You've gone through and you've studied it to the degree that you now have publishable work. You've had a lot of findings that are novel and new and have never been shown in the literature before. And so in the introduction, you want to go through all of the things that were studied before your study, that led to your study, that struck you as being important. And you highlight all that work. And then you transition from what was done to what you did. And that's sort of called the non-technical overview. And that's generally the last paragraph in the introduction, is the non-technical overview that transitions from your work or from the previous work into your work. Now, we're working from Pavia, so, and we're not doing anything novel. We're reproducing work. And so we don't have anything novel to talk about in that way. So what we want to do, our introduction does two jobs. Stimulates interest, tells what was done previously. What was done previously is pretty much what we're going to do. But the stimulating interest part and why it's important, that is critical information. And so our introduction is going to be about the previous synthesis and introduction of acetyl salicylic acid. The medical component of how it works or why it works, that's an important function, not necessarily in the biochemistry of how it works, although I did go over that because I wanted you to know it, but the importance of the medication itself on how big a market share acetyl salicylic acid is. It's taken by millions and millions, if not billions of people worldwide. It's a multi-billion dollar market. It treats so many different diseases and so many different health effects, from fevers to pain to heart disease, to just all kinds of things. So that is your introduction, would be why acetyl salicylic acid is such an important compound, and how it was one of the first pharmaceuticals that went from being a natural product that was isolated to a modified product that could be marketed and sold to the consumer and had a better healthcare outcomes from being modified. So that's kind of what we want to hit in that introduction. And then the non-technical overview, that's the last paragraph. And the non-technical overview sort of does what the abstract did. It goes over the work, but in slightly more detail than what the abstract did. Still not getting into temperatures, percents, and all of those different things, concentrations, but giving a little bit more detail than what the abstract did. Something else here. The abstract may contain theoretical background, chemical names, formulas, equations, structures. All information in this section should include references to the literature where the material was found. Wikipedia is not the best source for information. However, and while it shouldn't be used as a primary source, it's not a bad source in reality. Wikipedia has gotten much better over the years. And so I allow more leniency in terms of the Wikipedia thing, but still, if we were to go to Wikipedia and to search on acetyl salicylic acid, then what comes up, while great information, also has at the bottom of the article all of the references of where they got all that information. And there are just a huge number of references here that we could pull up, and we could use the references as our primary references. And so not all of these articles will be accessible to you. Some of them will be. This one happens to be free, and we could pull up the article and we could look at it. But that's a good way to get away from actually using the Wikipedia itself, or using Wikipedia itself as a primary source. But we could pull many of the different references that are in Wikipedia and use those as references. So that's a great idea. And I also realize that within the context of Cabrillo and your access to information, UCSC, most four-year universities have access to the primary literature for all of their students. So you can go into the library and you can use Web of Science, you can use the Science Citation Index, you can use ChemEd Scholar. There's a number of different, Chem Scholar, I think it's called. There's a number of different search functions that allow you to be able to search all of the peer-reviewed journal articles dating back to the early 1800s. It's amazing what is online now and what has been digitized for you to be able to read online. And all of that is accessible through places like UCSC. In order to have that chemical literature at Cabrillo, our lead librarian at UCSC used to work for the UC system in the library system and knows what the costs are on those. And so in discussions that he and I have had over trying to get certain resources for Cabrillo, he's made it known to me that if we wanted to have the same resources, for instance, that UCSC does, that it would take 10 times the library budget for the entire year for that single resource to be able to give access to the chemical literature to Cabrillo students. It's infeasible for us to be able to afford that for the community college system. And so that's been a hard thing, is not having the primary literature. How do you teach a science when you don't have the primary literature? Physics is in the same boat. Biology is in the same boat. We just don't have access to those primary literatures through our library. And so for the sciences, our library is really worthless. Fortunately, UCSC is a community library. In essence, the library resources at UCSC are freely accessible to the entire community. And you need only to walk into the library, sit down at any computer terminal, and you have access to everything in the library. You can't check out books, so you cannot borrow the books. Although you can apply for a community library card there, and I think you can actually borrow a limited number of books as a community member. But as a student at Cabrillo, you can sit down, use the library, have full access to all of the online resources, and you can take a USB drive, throw it into the computer, and download whatever it is you want onto that USB drive, and it's all freely accessible to you. And if you want help from the librarian, they will not ask you for a UCSC library card. They will just sit down next to you and help you as if you were a UCSC student without any questions and show you how to use those library resources and how to find the resources you're looking for. But that's hard. I mean, you got to take a drive up to UCSC. You got to pay for parking. I think it's $10 for the day. You got to find parking and then make your way into a library that you're unfamiliar with and find all the resources. And we do that second semester. And I ask you guys as a group to go up and do it together when you form your research groups and to go up and do individual research that way, because it's the only way you can do it. And we need those primary literature resources from UCSC in order to move forward with the special projects. And I help you at Cabrillo as well, because as a research associate at UCSC, I still have access to the peer-reviewed literature. So I can pull it up. We can go through and do all the search functions from my office or from any computer where I can sit down and I can log in, and we can pull up all of those things. So we have some sources for you to help you when we get to that point in special projects. For right now, we'll stick with Wikipedia and what we can find online. Okay, that's the introduction. That's the long talk there. Let's talk about the methods and materials section. Methods and materials section can go in a number of different places. Different journals will have it right before the results section. Some will have it right after the introduction. It can go in a number of different places. There's no set place where it has to go. I like to see it after the introduction, just because it makes sense before you start talking about your work to actually go through the methods and materials that you use to obtain those results. The methods and materials has two sections. It has the methods and it has the materials, normally listing the materials first. And so in this section here, I've got all reagents should be listed and sources cited. That means chemical one, chemical two, chemical three, and where they were obtained. Yours were obtained from the Cabrillo College stockroom and used without modification. if they're obtained from some other source, or if you modify them, then we have to be sure and list that. The make and model of all the instrumentation that you use should be characterized and reported, including any software used for analysis. So the equipment are things like the melt temp that you use, the digital thermometer that hooks to the melt temp, the FTIR instrument, as well as any software that is running on the computer for the FTIR. All of those things need to be listed such that a researcher who wants to reproduce your work could go through and buy chemicals from the same vendor and could obtain the same materials and the same purity and the same
instrumentation.
Ow, Finley, excuse me. You just completely ripped me apart here. All right, one second, coming back online. The hazard of pets while lecturing. Oh my God. All right, I'm alive. I'm okay. Nobody panic. All right, can you guys hear me? Just gotta check and make sure all my equipment's working. Okay, cool. So I switched to a slightly longer cord for my headphones so I can move around my office a little bit more easily when I'm lecturing. And Finley decided that he desperately wanted up in my lap while my wife was grabbing something out of the file cabinet. And in doing so, he got tangled up in my cord and completely ripped my cord out of my headphones and ripped the cord out of the back of the microphone while taking the microphone with it. So cascade failure there, but I think we're all back and exciting. It's never a dull moment around here. Okay. All right, so all of that needs to be in there in the methods and material section. If the procedure was followed unmodified, you may simply cite your lab manual specifying sections that were performed. For instance, the procedure in Pavia et al. With a reference number was followed without modification. Any deviations, additions, omissions to the reference procedure must be clearly stated. So here's an example, or actually what I should say is your equipment. So you have a Meltemp that is a Meltemp 2 by Barnstead and Thermaline. And it's a model 1001 with a Fluke 51 K/J digital thermometer. The IR instrument is a Nicolet Avatar 360 ESP with Omnic 8 software by Thermo Fisher. So that's what you guys are actually using in class. And an example of how that section would be written up, here's this example. So this is an example that is taken from the Grignard experiment, which is the first experiment that we do second semester. And it shows how you would take a procedure from Pavia and consolidate it down into a written procedure. Because what Pavia does is Pavia throws in all kinds of extra explanations of how you exactly go through and do the experiment. And what we want is a more concise written down procedure that tells you just exactly what to do. It may not give you every single step, but gives you the majority of steps that somebody knowledgeable in the art would be able to reproduce. So here's the listing of chemicals and equipment for the Grignard experiment. Bromobenzene, magnesium turnings, and anhydrous diethyl ether, 6 molar hydrochloric acid, and petroleum ether were obtained from the chemistry stockroom and used without modification. Melting points were determined using a Barnstead Thermaline Meltemp 2 model 1001 equipped with a Fluke 51 KJ digital thermometer. Infrared spectra were obtained on a Perkin-Elmer 1600 series FTIR. And then I go into a bunch of other stuff here that that is NMR, just because I wanted you to see some other information that was presented, even though we don't have an NMR or utilize that. So ours would have ended right after that Perkin-Elmer 1600 series FTIR. And we would have also put in there the Omnicate software. So that piece was missing. Notice too that here I'm using a Perkin-Elmer 1600, whereas up above I said that what we currently have is a Nicolet Avatar 360 FTIR ESP. That is true. The old Perkin-Elmer was a 1600. The new instrument that we currently have is the Nicolet Avatar 360. So I didn't update the paragraph yet. The procedure is probably equally important to look at. First off, when writing a paragraph, never start off with a number. So this should not be the number 15 milligrams. You should always start off with words. And so if you feel the need to start off with a measurement, then write it out in words, 15 milligrams of magnesium rather than the number 15. That should always be put into parentheses, 6.43 millimoles. So we're always putting in the mass and the number of millimoles to make it easy for people to understand what it is that we're doing. We're placed into a 20 mil round bottom flask. The flask was fitted with a magnetic stir bar, a Claisen head with rubber septa, and drying tube. A solution of bromobenzene, 1.01 grams, 6.43 millimoles, in anhydrous diethyl ether, 4 milliliters, was added to the stirred reaction flask via syringe dropwise. Addition of bromobenzene diethyl ether solution was maintained at a rate to produce a steady reflux of the reaction mixture. A reflux means boiling. So we added it at a rate to have a reflux. And when we say a reflux or boiling, when you look at an air condenser or any sort of condenser and the material is boiling, inside the condenser, what you can see is an area that is sort of wavy that that looks like, how do I even describe it? Almost like hot air. When you see hot air and you look through hot air and you can see sort of the wavy lines that hot air can create, that's what a reflux looks like. It is the area where liquid and gas coexist at the same time. And so the gases, the hot gases are coming up, they're condensing on the sides, they're forming a liquid, and that liquid is dripping back down. And when you look below the reflux is maybe only a centimeter in width. When you look below the reflux, it goes back to being just normal glass. Above the reflux looks like normal glass. At the reflux, you see this waviness in the liquid forming, which is really, really cool. And that's an indication that your material is boiling and is recondensing and dropping back down into the flask. So that's what that term means. After addition of bromobenzene diethyl ether, the reaction was allowed to cool to room temperature. A solution of benzophenone, 1.09 grams, 5.98 millimoles in anhydrous diethyl ether, 2 milliliters, was added rapidly via syringe. The reaction was allowed to stir for 20 minutes. The reaction was quenched, meaning stopped, with HCl 6 milliliters. The resulting biphasic system was separated using a separatory funnel and the aqueous phase extracted with 10 milliliters diethyl ether. The ether layers were combined and evaporated to yield a yellow solid oil mix. The solid was triturated, that's a special word that means washed in essence, with petroleum ether and filtered to yield crude triphenyl methanol, 1.25 grams, 4.80 millimoles. Notice that every step, every time I have a solid material or something that I've isolated or something that I'm added, I'm listing the amount and the millimoles. The crude material was recrystallized from isopropanol to afford the pure triphenyl methanol. And then the last sentence or the last part is the characterization. We always give the characterization after the procedure. Yield 1.04 grams, 4.00 millimoles, 67%. So I'm listing it in grams, in mass, millimoles, and percent. The melting point, 160 to 161 degrees Celsius, FTIR, solid KBR pellet, telling what type of pellet we used, and its measurement, reciprocal centimeters. And then I list the important peaks, the important wavelengths. That's the whole characterization. So something to note here is that this was the methods and materials section. And we would assume that in the results section, I'm going to list these results that I just characterized right here, I'm gonna list them all again. And that's true, that formal reports are redundant in many different places. There are equal materials or equal, there are parts that I put in over and over again within the formal report. You say, well, that's really redundant. Most of the time within chemistry, we try not to do redundant things. So why are we being so redundant in our formal reports? And the answer is that in a literature paper, literature papers are not read start to finish in a linear fashion. That when I read a paper, And it doesn't matter whether it's a chemistry paper or a biology paper. Like, I'm reading all the stuff on COVID-19 right now, and I'm reading from the primary literature, and I read those papers in the exact same way that I read a chemistry paper. I read the title first. The title either grabs me or it doesn't. It's something I'm interested in, I want to read, or I just thumb on by. The next thing I read is the abstract. What is it that they did? What is it that they found? And then after I read the abstract, if I'm still interested, then I go to their conclusion. I skip everything else. I may actually, as I'm going through the paper, look at some of their figures, but mainly I jump from the figures and go right to the conclusion because I want to see in more detail what it was that they found. And then if I'm still interested after the conclusion, then I go back and I read their methods and materials. And I read the methods and materials because I want to see, was the study done in a way that the data is reliable? And if the data is reliable and I'm still interested, then I'll sit down and I'll read their discussion section and I'll read the entire thing and pick it apart piece by piece. And then I'll jump around some more and go back to their methods and materials section and read that some more and see how they actually went about doing things. But and at different times, we go to different pieces of the paper. For instance, if we're doing the synthesis and trying to repeat it, then I want to go right to the methods and materials section, and I want to grab that paragraph and have that paragraph just there and available to me, and I want to read that whole paragraph again as I'm sitting down to do this procedure. And at the end of it, when I'm getting my data, I want to sit down and I have that characterization field right there where I can just match up exactly what I'm getting and not have to look all over the paper for it. It's all put right in one cohesive place. So it's redundant because we use the paper for different purposes at different times, and most people don't read them in a linear fashion. That's the main thing. So there's lots of redundancy. So that's not a bad thing. Okay, any questions so far? Kind of what I'm covering. Nope, guys are doing okay. All right. I'm also going to apologize to some degree that usually when we do a lecture, there's a lot of active components. I'm writing on the iPad. We're looking at the mechanisms in lecture. It's all writing and it's all active in terms of what we're doing. And I know you're passively watching, but at least you're watching and thinking about each step. Teaching writing and teaching formal reports is excruciatingly painful for me as an instructor, because although I know how important it is, I also know that we've put so much emphasis on activity and doing that to sit down and all of a sudden focus on writing, and particularly in a Zoom format like this, it's got to be exhausting to sit and watch just the screen and to talk about the different sections in the writing. So I know this is not the easiest format to do this in, but I also don't know any other way to break down what it is I'm looking for and what's important in terms of constructing a formal report. So that's kind of where we're at. Okay, results section. The results section includes data, tables, graphs, and in some cases for Chem-1B, sample calculations, but not for Chem-12. All tables and graphs will have appropriate titles and generally be about a half page in size. The axis of the graphs will be properly labeled, including units. Results should be summarized as in text as well as tables. And I know it's redundant, but that's only because our data sets are rather small. So in a paper where there are huge data sets, it is common to break down those data sets in the results sections and talk about them in a parenthetical way, in a paragraph, as opposed to just putting them into a table and having the tables be standalone. So we always explain the tables and explain the results that are being presented there. Then the discussion section, this is where we do a couple of different jobs. Normally, what you would do is you would discuss your outcomes and how consistent they are, or how accurate they are, or what your models are. For us, for organic chemistry, the main thing that we want to focus on is the reaction mechanisms. That for the reports that we're generally doing, the mechanisms are the main thing that there's two main things. One main thing is the mechanism that I want you to focus on. I want you to develop a voice for communicating why chemical reactions go the way that they do. And that means breaking the mechanism down into its minutia, breaking it down step by step, and finding words to talk about each step that is not a single sentence, but multiple sentences. You should be able to expound a paragraph on a single step in a reaction mechanism, even a protonation. Some protonations are different than others, but say our first step in the acetyl salicylic acid, when we protonated acetic anhydride, the protonation of acetic anhydride is the first step and activates the acetic anhydride for nucleophilic attack. Without it, the reaction doesn't take place. So how does that actually activate it? And it goes through the resonance and how the positive charge is shifted from the oxygen to the carbon and how that increases the partial positive on the carbon, making it a stronger electrophile. And thereby the salicylic acid can then attack it to make a new carbon oxygen bond. So breaking it down and finding the words to actually explain what is happening, how that changes the structure, how that moves the reaction mechanism forward, that's the first job of the discussion section. The second job is to discuss your characterization, and each characterization should have its own paragraph. The melting point should be its own paragraph. The ferric chloride test should be its own paragraph. The FTIR should be its own paragraph. So each of the characterization steps should be a paragraph in and of itself, and they should also be, as you go each step into the next characterization, should be hearkening back, making sure that your characterizations are matching. So for instance, if your ferric chloride test showed negative for phenol, you could also say that that this is consistent with the melting point having the sharp melting point of 134 to 134.5 degrees Celsius, which is in line with the expected literature value for acetyl salicylic acid. So we want to make sure that they're also, that we're making those good arguments that they're matching up. So the mechanism is broken down into individual reaction steps. Each step should be preceded by a figure and caption illustrating the step. The text should then explain what is taking place. The figures, this is important, can be hand-drawn, as can the caption headings. Computer-drawn images are really, really nice, but they also take you a ton of time, and I don't want you to spend that much time doing this. Also, those programs are incredibly expensive. So ChemDraw, which is here, ChemDraw is $580 for an educational license. It is an incredibly expensive program, and it allows you to do some really cool things so that when we want to draw acetyl salicylic acid, it's really easy to go in and draw it and to change everything around as we need to, put the carboxylic acid in there. I think I made a mistake here. We'll catch it. And when I'm doing a reaction mechanism, oh yeah, I forgot that they changed some of these things that I can just go in and change. Here and OH, that what I can do is that I can copy this and drag it around to make my reaction mechanisms and my schemes and throw in my arrows, and then I can do quick modifications. That all of this stuff is really nice, but also totally unnecessary for what you guys need to do. So like I said, that to get that type of drawing program to be able to do those things, about $580. There are some cheaper ones, but even the cheaper ones are still over $100, like $125 for ChemDoodle at this point. ChemDoodle has gotten pretty expensive, and it doesn't do as good a job as what ChemDraw does. So hand draw them. Draw them in pencil. Just when you're writing your paragraphs, leave space for the figure, and then go in and draw the figure in by hand and write the caption in by hand, and call it good. And it's as every bit as good to me as if you had done it fully out on the computer. Okay. So don't spend time trying to find the perfect computer drawing. Definitely do not spend time going online, trying to find an image online that is just what you want it to be so that you can paste it in as your reaction scheme. Don't do that either. Draw it by pencil. Just draw it in. We're all good. Nobody's getting a better grade by spending more time trying to do it on computer. Okay. And That way it just saves you a whole lot of time. Spend your time writing, not trying to figure out how to draw. Okay. I think I've covered the rest of this. Okay, the conclusion section is very brief, single paragraph. Most often, it's a restatement of the abstract. So don't get too carried away in the conclusion. It's really just restating what was done and what was found and re-hitting your bottom line that your evidence shows that you made what you say you made. Okay. And then we've got the language and formatting component. So I've got some hints in here. In general, the report is written in third person, personal observer voice. For example, 10 grams of sodium hydroxide was weighed, not I weighed 10 grams of sodium hydroxide. In that regard, there are some places where you have to switch into first person. If you are comparing your results to somebody else's, for instance, let's say that Pavia gave you a percent yield that this reaction could be done in a 97% yield, and you wound up with a 67% yield, and you were going to compare your results to Pavia's. In our hands, or in my hands, I was only able to achieve a 67% yield, although Pavia quotes 97% yields as being expected. There's no other way to say that than to do it as first person. And that is common throughout the literature, that you will see that when a writer switches from writing about their experiment to comparing with other individuals and what's been able to be done in other labs, they will switch into a first person voice. That's acceptable and expected. Okay. Reports are generally typed, although handwritten is okay as long as they're legible. Equations, calculation structures can be written by hand, even within a typed report. You just leave space and go back in and put it in. All right, the difference between a figure, a chart, a scheme, a table. Figures are small things. They're like standalone structures. Or sometimes a figure can be just a single step within a mechanism. Those are figures. Charts are where you have many structures within a table, essentially. It's like a table, but it has structures in it. And the structures then have pieces of data that go along with each structure. That's what we call a chart. A scheme is like an entire reaction diagram that shows either a flow chart or shows a separation scheme, which is a type of flow chart, or shows an entire reaction mechanism from start to finish. That's a scheme. And then a table is a list of information. You guys know what a table is, but a table is a list of information, generally compound names, with various results for each compound that are shown within the table. So most of the things that we do is a table of results, and then we do figures. We don't do a whole lot of charts and schemes because our experiments are of a smaller nature and don't require charts and schemes with multiple pieces of data like that. This just explains a little bit more in detail the differences and where the captions go. Captions for figures go below the figure, and the caption for a table goes above the table. In fact, the table is the only one where the caption is generally put above the table. And why that's true, I think when you look at a figure, a chart, and even a scheme to some degree, you look at the figure in its entirety, and then you read the title to figure out what it was about. When you look at a table, you have no idea what a table is about until you actually read the caption for the table telling you what it is that's in the table. And so the caption for the table usually comes before the table, whereas for the others, it always goes below. The caption is generally 2 points smaller in font than the body text and indented both left and right such that it fits underneath whatever the caption scheme figure it is. Each caption is numbered sequentially within that graphical image type. For instance, you may have figures 1 through 8, and then you wish to put in a table. Your table then would be table 1 and table 2, so that the numbering is consecutive throughout each individual type. References. For references, references are either done as footnotes or endnotes. So you can do either. I tend to prefer the footnotes as opposed to endnotes rather than putting them all at the end. Having a reference there on the page where it appears is a really nice way to do things. It's much easier to read and to see where all the references are coming from. The references are cited within the text differently depending upon the specific journal. So what I'm going to ask you to do is to use superscripted number directly following the information cited. So this could be mid-sentence, for instance, here is a mid-sentence reference, or it could be at the end where the reference follows the period and is superscripted after the period. Either is acceptable. The reference should be sequential in order of use. However, a reference can be used more than once. For instance, after using a reference in the introduction as reference 3, is okay to invoke reference 3 again in the discussion, even though the next unique reference may be number 9. So for instance, I go through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and then I want to go back and use 3 again. I don't do a new reference 10 and cite it again. I just recite 3 and call it good and do it that way. So here's some examples on how to cite books, journals, patents, and web pages. And to see them actually in use, I have them down here, examples of different things. So this is a reference from number 1 would be a book. Number 2 is a number of different journal periodicals. Number 3 is a patent. Number 4, 5, and 6. 4 is a web page. 5 is actually the ACS style guide, and 6 is the short guide to writing about chemistry. These two references together are fantastic references. And if I stop the screen share for a second, I think I'll stop it over here so that you guys can see me on camera. What I've got is the American Chemical Society style guide. And this book here, this was reference number 5. The ACS style guide is a fantastic writing reference. If you are, if you're going on in chemistry and chemistry is your major, then this is a book that I would highly recommend getting in its current version. I don't know, this is the 3rd edition. I think it's in like 6th edition at this point or something, but the book is fantastic. It gives you not only good writing tips to tell how to write about science, so it gives you great examples of good writing and poor writing and how to write about each section. So it talks about all the different sections and how to format those sections and how to do all that. It's also extraordinarily good at how to write up all of your data. So the different types of data, whether it be mass spec data, NMR data, IR data, all types of things that we don't even do, cyclic voltaic, I can't even remember how to say that. Cyclic voltaic electrometry. Oh, I just killed that word. Anyway, all the different types of things of data that are within the chemistry field, it tells you how to write them up. And it also has all the different ways to cite different journals and abbreviations for all of the common journals so that you know exactly how to abbreviate them and do that. And much more. I'm not even hitting everything that's in here. And I go back in my own writing. I've got several tabs that are set up in this book. And I go back to this book all the time. And I have one in my office here at home. I have one at Cabrillo in my office. And I have another 2 of them, I think, in the classroom at Cabrillo. So even if you just want to pick one up when we get back, and look at it and see what's there. I try to make these as widely available as I can, and I should get them in the library down in the library as well. But phenomenal guide to writing, highly recommended. The other one was one that Christy Vogel liked, and this one is called A Short Guide to Writing About Chemistry, and it also is a fantastic writing guide, more so on the writing side than the data structure side. This doesn't tell you how to handle data as well as the American Chemical Society style guide, but it also is a really good resource. If you were gonna get one or the other, get the other one. But if you're going on in chemistry, also a fantastic resource. And like I said, those are both cited right there. So going back and sharing this, those are both cited right there, citation 5 and 6, the American Chemical Society style guide, and a short guide to writing about chemistry. I also have to apologize. By the time I get to this point in my day, I start slurring my words. It's almost like I've had a stroke at this point. You talk for this many hours and eventually you start running out of, your tongue stops working the way you want it to work. So I got to slow down a little bit. Drink a little bit, unstick things. Okay. I've been talking about writing for a good long time now. And I think that hits everything that I want from my instructions to authors. It's all there online. It's there both in PDF format so that you can download the PDF and print it out if you want. It's in the HTML so that you can go back and read it easier online. The formal report rubric is also here. And what I normally like to do is I normally like to print out 3 journal articles. I give you 2 from the literature. One that I think is really well written from the literature and accessible given our chemistry knowledge, and another one which is poorly written from the literature, also accessible given our chemical knowledge. And I have you sit down with the formal report rubric and score those papers and go through and show you that using the rubric, you can actually get the same score or very close to the score that I would get. And after sitting down and reading, and it's kind of a quiet exercise, and it's very different in lab than what we normally do. But what we do is we sit down and we score all of them through the rubric. And then we put up everybody's scores on the board and look to see how close that everybody got. And usually everybody is within, I would say, 2 or 3 points of each other on a 20-point rubric. Or 24-point rubric, maybe even closer than that, in that the rubric does a pretty good job of allowing you to be able to gauge your own work if you were to sit down with the rubric and go through your own work with the rubric. So I don't want to spend an enormous amount of time going through each category in the rubric. It's broken down in the same way that you've seen me break things down before: abstract, introduction, methods and materials, results, discussion, conclusion, and a language and grammar formatting to look at the overall paper itself. And if we just go down the mastery column, that abstract is between 80 and 200 words. Don't hold me to that. If it's smaller, I understand, but I'm trying to not to have you guys be too wordy. So I'm giving you an idea of how long it should be. It should be written in the past tense, describes the work that was done and the results found without using experimental details. The introduction describes the motivation and focus of the experiment, contains appropriate theoretical background. Last paragraph is a non-technical overview of the experiment. The lab manual and other materials, this is for the methods and materials. The lab manual and other materials properly cited, deviations, additions, omissions are clearly expressed in paragraph format. The results section, results, data presented in table format and discussed in paragraph format. All data tables, graphs, half page with correct captions. Discussion and conclusion. The results analyzed to produce sound conclusions. All experimental difficulties, errors, questions discussed correctly. Last paragraph is the conclusion, expressing briefly the bottom line of the experiment. And then the language and grammar and formatting, third person used throughout where appropriate. Well-formed sentence structure, grammatically correct. Excellent, consistent formatting. One more word about the discussion and conclusion section. I said that there were 3 main areas. I said there was 2. I should have said 3. The first one that we talked about in the discussion and conclusion section was where you're going through and you're doing the mechanism and you're writing about the mechanism itself. And that's the writing exercise that I'm going to have you do coming up here in a little bit that we're going to talk more about. The second thing was to go through and discuss all of your results and drawing the sound conclusions. The third thing that I do is that all the questions that are in the back of Pavia, or the questions that I assign that are in the back of Pavia, I don't want those tagged on to the report at the end of the report and have you just answer those questions. What I want is for you to use those questions that are at the back of Pavia as a guide to writing your discussion and conclusion. And what I mean by that is that Pavia asks several questions like, what happens if you overheat the reaction? How does overheating the reaction possibly affect the product outcome? This is something that you could address within your discussion section, particularly when you're addressing the mechanism, such that while the phenol oxygen is the most nucleophilic oxygen and is the one that goes through and does the nucleophilic attack onto the carbonyl of the acetic anhydride, if the reaction is overheated, the other hydroxyl group that is on the carboxylic acid can also undergo nucleophilic attack, substituting on both the carboxylic acid and the phenol and making a product that we're not interested in. So those questions from Pavia are great questions to be able to expand your writing within your paragraphs in the discussion section, within the mechanism, to be able to address each one of those questions. And finding the appropriate place to do that within the discussion section is what I want. So I want you to take those questions and say, yeah, that's a great question, and this is where I should be addressing it. If it's a question about yields, you should be addressing it within your results section where you're discussing your percent yield. If it's a question about, I've already hit the one that was in the mechanism section. That would be what happens if you overheat the reaction. So finding a place to be able to address those questions within the discussion section is what I really want you to do. And you can rephrase the question and address it right there, but don't make it its own thing. Find a way to weave it into your discussion as if you were just addressing it, because that's really what you want to do in good scientific writing. When you're writing and you want to make it interesting and you're writing about your research, you want to address all those questions that a reader might have had but didn't have the opportunity to ask. So that's what you're trying to do within that writing assignment as well. So be aware of that those questions are not standalone. They're meant to be addressed within your writing, within the discussion section, okay? All right, and Matt, always there for the thumbs up for me. I much appreciate that, thank you. I'm trying to think what else I need to do now. I think that what I need to do is switch over to my iPad and talk about the writing assignment that I want to do. So let's do that. Let's stop the screen share. And after stopping that, let's switch to the iPad as Finley sounds off. And we'll make a new note. Okay, so here, what I want you to do is we're gonna do a writing assignment. I want you to write the discussion section on the mechanism of acetylsalicylic acid formation from salicylic acid and acetic anhydride. This is going to be due next Monday. So you got a week to do it. What I want is that each step of the mechanism gets broken down such that what we have is we have a figure So we'll have figure one. We'll have the title of that figure. And then you'll have a paragraph that will discuss that. And then we'll go to figure two. It'll have a title and you'll have a paragraph that breaks down that step. So we're going to take the reaction mechanism, whereas before we had these, we had the entire reaction mechanism. And it all just kept flowing one into the other. You're going to break this down into individual steps. And each time we have an arrow going forward, that's the next step. So for instance, what I would do is I would take this first piece, and that becomes your figure one. The next piece would become figure two, and so on. And you'll talk about each step. So for example, in starting, and you may want to have a paragraph before you start this that is just sort of an introduction of the mechanism itself, or just a sentence that says how you're starting off. But in essence, what we're looking at is taking the acetic anhydride and protonating it. And you may want to do this in two steps, or we may want to do it just in one. How you decide to format yours is up to you. This would be figure one, protonation of acetic anhydride. The synthesis of acetyl salicylic acid is acid catalyzed. The reaction starts. With the protonation of acetic anhydride. The carbonyl oxygen the carbonyl oxygen takes a proton from phosphoric acid resulting in a oxonium ion. Protonated carbonyl, or we could say a carbonyl with a positive charge. The oxonium ion increases the partial positive charge on the carbonyl carbon through resonance. maybe we want to show that resonance here, so that that resonance, now we do another figure that actually addresses that resonance. And how that increases the strength of this electrophile by increasing that positive charge on the carbonyl oxygen, carbon, making the carbon more electrophilic. So this could be figure number two. Resonance of protonated acetic anhydride. Okay, so you get the idea of what I'm trying to do here, step by step, and how we're going through and doing the step by step and breaking it down. And I know that you don't have the language on the tip of your tongue to be able to do this. But when I did the last video on last Monday, which was where I first addressed this reaction mechanism, I broke this mechanism down using that language. So what I want you to do is to go back and rewatch that video, and each step, taking more detailed notes, maybe writing down notes while also hitting that pause button, maybe backing up a step, listening to it again, and going through each step and catching what it is that I said about each step, and why that step is occurring and how that step is taking it forward, and breaking that down and writing about it and basically making that language your own on how you talk about each one of those steps. And the reason that I'm focusing on this component is because this is what's really going to help you in terms of lecture. That for me to make up data and to try to give you some formal report to write up here just doesn't make sense to me. That what does make sense to me is to focus on skills that are going to help you both in your communication, in your chemistry communication, both in the lab and in lecture, and focusing on writing about mechanisms and using language to talk about each mechanistic step and making that mechanism sort of ingrained within you is what I think is going to be of most value. So that's what I want you to do, is to write out that discussion section part, just the mechanism part itself, and to break each step down individually and to give each one a small paragraph and to talk about each thing. And I realize that some of the protonations, deprotonations towards the end do not move things along quite the same way that this protonation did. Although the one where it creates a good leaving group really does, that's an important one to really talk about. But some of the other ones where the proton is taken away and it's deprotonated and shuttled around, you might not have as much to say there. That's okay. Hit that step, give it a sentence or two, move on to the next one, and then expand on the next one where you really can. And that's what I want you guys to try and do for me for next Monday, okay? And like I said, for the steps themselves, feel free to write them in pencil. Save space in the computer, when you're writing out your paragraphs, write them in pencil, and then take a screen snapshot of it and see if you can get it into a PDF and get it to me that way. Okay? That's kind of the goal of what I'm looking for. How's that sound?
I have a quick question.
Go for it.
If we're like, so I know how like we write down the like the references and the reference page, right? But what if we're like, you know, quoting you or something? How would we do that?
In terms of quoting me for this, I don't think you need to. I think that it's assumed that you're taking the majority of your information from me in terms of the lecture that I did before. So I'm not so much worried about that. If it were a formal report and you were trying to quote me, that's a good question. I think that what you would do is you would quote it as a lecture, as a written talk, so that there are many times where we quote written talks, presented information. And the ACS style guide has a way of presenting that. You could do Dr. Jason Camera, presented in lecture on April 22nd, Zoom lecture, and you leave it at that. That it doesn't have to be anything more to it. But I'm not expecting you guys to quote everything off of me on these. I'm expecting you to go off of my notes and to build these arguments from that. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, Matt, absolutely. If you want to come into office hours and shoot me something or shoot me something on email and then join me in office hours, or even just shoot it to me on email, let me mark it up and send it back to you, I'm happy to do that as well. Both of those things are cool in terms of getting feedback. I think that's why I wanted to lengthen it out and give you until Monday. I didn't want to just turn this around and say, hey, this is due on Wednesday, because I want to give you some time. If you want to talk about it and you want some more help with it, then you can come and get help on it. So yeah, excellent question. Okay. One more thing that they asked me in the morning class, and I think that it's really important, and I want to discuss it here as well. Okay, so let me put this aside. And this is on a pretty serious note, because everybody is really concerned about grades right now, and understandably, they're concerned about where they sit. They're concerned about how I'm going to grade lab. And I want to give you more of my philosophy on teaching and really philosophy on lab and how I grade lab anyway, and what I'm going to do from here on going out. So my philosophy on lab is that I think of lab much more like a drama class. Not that there's a lot of drama in it, because sometimes there is, but in the way that a drama teacher grades drama students or an acting teacher grades acting students, there are presentations and there are things that they do that they are evaluated on, but they're always evaluated based on observations by the instructor. That there are no, I'm gonna close my door. There's no hardcore. And that's why I went to the longer cord that Finley just ripped out of my ear earlier. There's no hardcore sort of test, tangible written assignment that I look at like a lab practical or final in that way. I look to see how you progress. I look to see how you operate. I look to see what type of student you are. Are you organized when you come in? Are you on top of things when class starts? Are you listening to the advice that I'm giving and the instructions that I'm giving and following that advice? Are you improving as we go through the semester? So that when we do recrystallizations, and we do recrystallizations three or four times throughout the semester, and the first time you sucked at it, the second and third time, do you still need as much help from me in the second and third time? Second and third time, are you improving? Are your recrystallizations getting better each time as you learn these techniques? All of these things are observables that I assess the students on. And it's very, very easy to get an A or a B in my class. And in fact, almost everybody gets A's. And that to get a B doesn't mean that you're failing the class. Getting a B, there's certain reasons why students would get a B as opposed to a C or a D. But by far, the majority of the grades are A's and B's. And the vast majority are A's, because I grade so much on participation and I grade so much on effort and what you're doing, and a lot on effort too, that's like 90% of the grade. 90% is what you show me that you can do and are willing to do and be present while the lab is going on. The other 10%, although my rubric may say otherwise, the other 10% are the writing assignments and the questions and the answers. And so a student who is there every single day and is really good in lab and doesn't need a tremendous amount of correcting and is on top of spills and things when they happen and does the right thing when spills and things happen, and who makes an effort and turns everything in on time, is going to get an A in my class, even if they may not entirely understand all the questions and answer all the questions perfectly in those written assignments when they come back. A student who doesn't turn in one or two reports may wind up getting a B because the absence of the writing score on those one or two reports may knock them down into a B level. A student who is just a disaster in lab and is constantly occupying my attention such to keep them safe and to keep others around them safe will oftentimes get a B or maybe even a C, depending on the severity of how impacted they are and how much a danger they are in lab, because they're really not meeting, as though they may be trying, they may not be meeting those expectations. The only other way to really get a C is to not turn in anything for the semester and to hand me your laboratory notebook at the end and say, yeah, I know I was here every time and I didn't do the writing assignments, but here's all the work that I've done and it's all in my lab notebook. And I will frequently give that student a C because they have completed the majority. They've been there every single day. They've done all the work. I've seen that they've got the lab skills. I know they can do it. They just, for whatever reason, didn't do any of the writing components. And a D and an F in a failing grade is a student who made no effort, who didn't show up, and who was just a disaster in lab and trying to keep everybody safe and basically run interference between them and everybody else such that nobody gets hurt. That's the only way to really get a D grade or a failing grade in my class. So as far as I'm concerned, in the things that I saw out of everybody, everybody was doing extraordinarily well, and everybody was sort of on that A path as they were going through and doing the labs and what I saw. And I haven't introduced a whole lot of writing assignments or a whole lot of questions because I didn't want to pile more work onto you guys in an already difficult situation. I'm watching what is going on with my girls right now. They're both in college, and they're one of them's in the STEM, one of them's more in the arts right now, but both of them, their instructors are piling on work because they're figuring that these people are working from home, not trying to work from home. They think that they're working from home rather than trying to work while being at home. I think that's the best way to say it. And they're piling so much work onto them that they can't keep up with the amount of work that each instructor is requiring them. And each instructor is forgetting about the other two or three classes that those students may be taking. And it's absolutely killing them. And I didn't want to contribute to that. I was very aware. And for lab, I'm also very aware that I only really want you to answer questions in a sense when you're actually doing in the lab and to relate them back to the physical things that you've been doing. So where it makes sense, like this writing assignment, that's what I want to put emphasis on and have you do. And how much emphasis am I going to put on it in terms of your grade? Well, it's going to count. I'm going to throw it in there. But by and large, I think that we can all get out of this with excellent outcomes as long as you're turning in the work. And I'm already extraordinarily happy in everything that I've seen you done. And we got through the majority of the skill sets that I wanted you to get through. I would have liked for you to see the IR instrument and learn how to take IRs, because that's a big component of what we do second semester in our analysis. And I'd like you to be able to function independently in the IR room. And we're going to have to take time for me to teach you how to use the IRs next time. And so I'm going to have to take some time out of lab next time to allow for that. But by and large, you have the skill sets that I need you to have to move forward. And that's a good thing. So I'm trying not to overwhelm you with work. And it may seem like you're afraid because I'm not giving you enough. Well, it's really because I'm trying to hold back and trying not to give you too much and allow you time to be able to go to work and do the things that you need to do for those people that are working. Realizing that you have changed your schedules all around and that some of you are working at times when you wouldn't have been working otherwise. Realizing that the stress is making it hard enough to complete assignments or to stay on top of things, and not wanting to contribute to that, and just trying to be aware of you guys. So if you're feeling confused why I'm not giving you just a shit ton of work, that's why. So that's my little pep talk there. I hope that's clear, and I hope that's working out for everybody. And any questions on what it is I want you to do here in terms of this writing assignment?
Oh, yeah. So does it have to be like multiple pages, or like how are we doing this? Is it like, you know, Cabrillo standard, you know, English writing course where like it's got to be three pages? It's got to be like, you know, MLA format and all that?
No, Finn, it has to do its job. So what I've asked you to do is I've asked you to break out each individual image. So you have to allow room for the image. And then you're going to have a paragraph, more or less, that is going to be underneath each image describing what is actually taking place in that reaction mechanism. So if you think through the mechanism, I think there were six major steps in the mechanism, plus maybe a seventh if you're going to include resonance. So that may take you 5 pages to get through if you're double spacing everything and writing it out. It's not about the pages, it's about the content. It's about did you do the job in terms of explaining what's going on in each step. So don't get caught up in the pages. Don't get caught up in the number of words. This is not about a number of words. This is not about a number of pages. It's about, does the writing do the job that you needed to do?
Okay. And then, like you said earlier, that it can't be written like a novel, but what if that's just how you write? Me particularly,
yeah.
I've gotten A's in English like my entire life, and I've like almost written a novel before. So it's pretty easy for me to like make a paragraph and just like kind of roll through the whole thing, you know. But like, I still give out the information. So is that okay, or do you just want it to be like direct, concise, and like, you know, just cut out all the extra stuff?
Okay, that is good scientific writing. Is concise and on point. That being said, concise and on point doesn't mean it has to be dry, but you don't want to spend an enormous amount of time trying to make it flowery or witty or funny. The whole idea of scientific writing is that scientific writing generally is fairly dry and on point. However, there are great scientific writers. One of my favorites is Joe Bennett. Joe Bennett passed away several years ago. He was a professor at UCSC. And Joe Bennett did electrophilic aromatic substitution and is one of the giants in organic chemistry. So much so that his name does not appear anywhere within any of the organic chemistry textbooks, but his chemistry is everywhere. It's fascinating that when somebody does one single named reaction, their name gets pinned to it and the reaction gets named after them and you see it everywhere. And then there are people that contribute to a broad area of chemistry and their name never appears anywhere, and yet there were these amazing giants within that area. Joe Bennett was one of those giants. And Joe wrote a paper, I think it was in the 60s, late 60s, that was written entirely in iambic pentameter and was published. And it's a fantastic paper. And he was both being humorous and doing great chemistry at the same time. So it's not to say that chemistry writing can't be fun or interesting, but in general, it's there to do a specific job, and to detract from that makes the paper more difficult and the content less accessible to your reader. So try to find a medium between wanting to make it like an English paper and having very witty language and trying to do the job of communicating effectively. And there's a medium there to be had. You just need to find it. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I like to capture my reader's attention, you know, and kind of like, you know, create this like this arena in my reader's head, and like have them like, you know, basically have what I'm writing, like, you know, portray like a play, like a Shakespearean play, like out in their head, like how they can see it, you know. It's not really all about cut and dry. It's more about like, you know, what can I show you that's different that I can express about this paper. That's what I try to, you know, accomplish, and usually I achieve that. So yeah. I don't know if like I should be able to, I don't know if I can do this.
Like, I wouldn't say try to do
you
that
want me I, to, but yeah. Like
I would say don't try to do that. Just hearing your explanation of that makes me concerned in the way that you're approaching the writing assignment. Try to approach it from a more direct approach and see what happens. And if you want to shoot to me a draft of something that you start, maybe even before you go too far into it, and you want to see kind of how it's reading, shoot it to me on email and let me take a look at it, and I'll mock it up and shoot it back to you.
Okay. Do you want like an abstract of like before, like of this thing? So no abstract. So it's just like,
no, just jump into it. Just with the discussion section. Just, this is where we would start the discussion section. And if you need some segue or introductory paragraph into it, go ahead and do that. But yeah, I don't need a separate abstract.
All right. Got it.
Matt, you had a question. You lean towards passive voice. I don't think that's going to be a problem. I think, yeah. Yeah, I think this is going to be cool. Maybe you lean more naturally towards scientific writing. I think that's going to be good. I could see where that would be a problem with English, though. Yeah, good English writing. Good scientific writing should also be good English. It just doesn't have to be creative like English. It does a different job. You don't have to grab your reader by your sentence structure. You have to grab your reader by your content and by the way you present the ideas and making those ideas accessible to your reader. That's good scientific writing. That's what you want to try to achieve. So try to achieve it by how effectively you're communicating rather by the way in which you're communicating. I think that's the goal. Okay. All right. That's all I got for you guys today. So unless there's any further questions, I suggest we call it a day. We'll take a shorter day today for once. You're welcome, Matt. Are we all in agreement?
Yep. Thanks, Jason.
You're welcome, Eric. Thanks for the good questions, Finn.
Nope. What's going on?
Yeah. Thank you, Jason. I appreciate all your help.
Okay. You're welcome. We'll see you guys on Wednesday.